I think the postcards that are being handed out are the SGA postcards, so get those and fill them out and hand them back into SGA if necessary. Couple of things. I still have not received all of the reports from the various groups, all of the groups from the breakout sessions for last week. So if your group, I mean, I have the list, and if you're not sure, you can ask me. I don't want to go through all 12 groups at this point. But if your group has not reported, if you were the designated reporter for a particular group and you haven't sent me your report, please do so in the next day or so. I also want to register mild disappointment with some of you, anyway, and probably not to most of the people who are sitting here. But I actually think that the breakout sessions, you know, for better or worse, are an important part of the class, an important part of what I view as the class. And as you know, those of you who were there, we took attendance at the breakout sessions. And I can't tell, I mean, maybe there's half the class isn't here right now. I can't tell. I don't know the difference between 150 and 250 when I'm looking around a room. And I don't take attendance in this class, but I think less than half the students were at the breakout sessions overall. So, I mean, again, it's something that I'm not thrilled with. And I think that was our last breakout session, so that's sort of the end of it. But for those of you who weren't there, who just skipped out, I ask you to look into your conscience and feel a little bit guilty. That's all right. You don't have to say anything to me. You don't have to come up and, you know, give penance. But, that's just the way it is. All right. The goal tonight, you know, let me just tell you, in terms of the rest of the semester, I'm juggling with people's schedules at this point, which is also turning out to be a pain in the neck. There are three guest speakers who have indicated a willingness to come and chat with you in the next few weeks. And I'm not 100% sure when any of them are coming at this point. So you're just going to have to bear with me. I mean, Jeff Sachs was scheduled to come on April 17th, but his assistant just contacted me the other day to say he had to be in, I don't know, Nigeria or somewhere on that day. And so that couldn't work, and he wants to work out another day. We'll see if that happens. I'm not sure, given the late date, but hopefully it will. Bob Challoner, who is the CEO of Cabrini Hospital, is scheduled to come on the 24th of April and talk about health information technologies. And he still is scheduled to come on that day, although the third speaker, another speaker who I had, who was supposed to come and talk about quality of care on the 17th, has now said the 17th might not work for him, and he wants to switch to the 24th. I mean, it's, you know, I'll have to sort of let you know who's coming when, and you may end up just having to listen more to me, being stuck with me, because if these people don't come. But we do have, we are 1 week behind on the schedule. This week we're going to do long-term care. The goal tonight is to talk about long-term care. Next week, April 3rd, I'm going to talk about public health and the American medical workforce. Then that leaves comparative quality, HIT, and sort of the open week that we had. And I want to get a sense of who's coming when in terms of the speakers before I make final decisions on that. So what I would say is, for sure, you know, this week long-term care, next week public health and workforce issues, and next week hopefully I'll have pinned down who's coming when, and we can sort of figure out how we're going to make up the week at that point. As you know, there are also the memos that you handed in on ERISA last week. We hope to have those back to you next week, next Monday. There'll be one more short memo on comparative health policy, and I'm going to send you the instructions for that memo this week. That's due April 24th. Essentially, you're going to be asked to pick a country, any country, other than the United States, and answer some questions about the healthcare system in that country. I'm not going to name the country, but I'm going to name the questions that I want you to ask. And then you'll have to sort of describe a little bit about that country's healthcare system, and then answer a couple of questions about potential lessons or thoughts for the United States from whatever country you happen to choose. And again, if you want to choose Canada, Britain, France, Western Europe, that's fine. If you want an Asian country, if you want an African country, that I really leave to you. And then there's the final paper. I have heard from a number of you about topics for the final paper. I am, according to my own reading of my own email, I'm up to about last night in terms of responding to people. So if you emailed me, and I'm not sure the TAs, I think, also get emails about this, but if anyone has emailed me before last night with a question about a paper and hasn't heard back from me, let me know at the break, because I think I've emailed everybody back who's written me up to last night. I think there were one or two people who wrote me this morning, just from looking quickly at email headings, but I had a crazy day today. So if you wrote me this morning, I just haven't gotten back to you, and I'll probably get back to you in the next 24 hours. But if you wrote me from last night or before, then somehow or another I didn't get the email, or at least I didn't realize I was supposed to respond to it, so let me know. Any other questions people have about... Yeah?
Were we supposed to let you know our topic of the day?
No, you didn't have to. You didn't have to. But a lot of people have just let me know, and I'm happy to... Or let the TAs know and talk about it. But there was no requirement, no checkoff requirement. Yeah?
I remember, the final paper. I don't know if I remember correctly, but I saw the last paper, the last short paper is the 24th.
Right.
And the final paper is the week after that.
Right. Right. Although the final paper is only twice as long as the... it's not a 30-page paper. It's a little bit more, and you should presumably be working on it now. And I know there's a lot to do. I've gone back and forth in this class, and this will be one of the things that you can, either yell at me or say is okay on evaluations. Because one of the things I've gone back and forth on many, many times in this class, I've taught this class for the last several years, and every year, in fact, the TAs, I'm sure, can tell you this, who all took the class previously, every year I have a different set of requirements. Last year, I think there was a midterm and a final exam and a paper. And it seemed to me that sort of just asking you questions in sort of a standard midterm and final, and then I got a lot of complaints last year because the final paper and the final exam were both basically at the same time, and people were saying they were both studying for the final exam and supposedly writing the paper. I've moved away from sort of exams in this class. So there's no formal exam, there's no midterm or final. It's much more sort of paper topic-driven, assignments. And you can let me know how you think it works or doesn't work at the end. Yeah. Well, I did lay out, and I think on CourseWorks now is a memo from me. Is that on CourseWorks? There is a memo from me on CourseWorks, which basically, and again, I lay out a particular format that I want you to follow on the paper. Really sort of ranging from the introduction to the policy question to the background to the options. I sort of lay a whole sort of description out as to what I want. And so I would just try to follow. Those people, there was a question that people have to get in touch with me about the paper. If you're planning on following the format, then you don't have to get in touch with me. If some people, for whatever reason, are writing something which is, and they don't want to follow that format, they want to, instead of writing a policy piece on a policy question, they want to write some historical piece on, whatever. They want to veer away from that format. Those people should just let me know what they want to write about, and I'm almost always going to say yes. But I think in terms of the paper itself, I would take a look at that memo and see what you think. Any other questions? Okie doke. So long-term care. Long-term care services, and these definitions are pretty standard, and I know Penny Feldman's chapter goes through some of these definitions pretty carefully. Long-term care services are essentially services, both health and social services of a variety of sorts, that are provided to people who are unable to engage in what you might call, that, to use the jargon, the activities of daily living. Sort of getting up, getting dressed, going shopping, cooking, taking care of themselves independently, are unable to engage in all of the activities of daily living because they've got some chronic disability, chronic illness, or long-term disability. And so they need help. They need help of one sort or another in engaging in those activities, you know, the kind of things that you and I, and I would assume most people in this class, if not everybody, just takes for granted on a daily basis. There are, and it's very, very, very tough. You have to be real careful when you use numbers on any of these areas. The, you know, Feldman in her chapter quotes an estimate of about 9.5 million Americans receiving long-term care services of one sort or another at this point, at any given time in the United States. The reason it's so tough to accurately know how many people are truly receiving long-term care is that the large, large majority of long-term care services are provided informally, unpaid for, by daughters, by sisters, by brothers, by mothers, by family members, by friends, by neighbors, you know, who just provide services for those around them, whether it's cooking meals, whether it's taking people to the doctor, whether it's providing transportation, whether it's coming over every day. I mean, just all of the kinds of things that are provided informally can also be provided formally, but the large majority of care is provided, long-term care is provided informally, primarily to people living in their homes. So it's very hard to get a real, and one person's definition of a long-term care service is another person's just being a good neighbor. And sort of stopping in and looking in on Mrs. Jones every other afternoon because, you know, Mrs. Jones is older and lives by herself and needs some help on occasion with picking up, you know, the groceries or doing the laundry or whatever. Not only is the majority of long-term care provided informally, prior to the 1940s and 1950s in this country, almost all long-term care was provided informally. There was, prior to the late 40s and early 1950s, very, very little of the kind of formal long-term care systems that we have today. There were very, very few nursing homes, as we think of nursing homes today. There were some mom-and-pop family homes. I mean, there were some folks, you know, who, you know, the kids would leave and they would open up their house and take in some elderly neighbors, elderly folks, and provide some services on their behalf. But they primarily did not provide medical services at all to them. They really had sort of more of a mom-and-pop old-age home. There were some immigrant self-help groups which provided services to the elderly, for members of their community. There certainly were, and we talked about this probably the very first week of the class, there certainly were the almshouses and the poorhouses. And so the most desperate, the most indigent, the most seriously disabled who had nowhere else to go would often end up in the almshouse. But most people, if they could, if they had relatives, would move in with their relatives when they couldn't take care of themselves, or the relatives would move in with them. Or they would be taken care of informally through some other route. And that system, to the extent you want to call it a system, that system of care survived, you know, through the 18th century, 19th century, and first half of the 20th century. It survived because we lived in a country during that era in which there were relatively few women in the workforce. And so it became part of sort of the woman's job, not paid, but the woman's job to take care of family members. It survived because we were a relatively immobile society. You know, most people in the 1800s and the early 1900s stayed where they were born. They lived in the same community that they were born in. They didn't travel, they didn't move from one community to another, certainly from one state to another, or one country to another. Families were much more geographically cohesive, even perhaps if not otherwise cohesive. Who knows? Maybe they've always been family. I'm sure there's always been family dynamics of troublesome sorts, but it certainly was the case that families lived nearby. And finally, and perhaps most importantly, there were relatively short gaps between disability and death. We didn't have much of the new technology, the pharmaceuticals, the drugs, the AIDS, the, you know, all the kind of things that the public health systems, you know, once you got really ill, medicine itself was not particularly good in the 1800s and early 1900s at extending your life for long periods of time so that you can live for long periods of time even while disabled. And so there were far fewer folks who actually needed long-term care services for an extended period of time. So it almost became, you know, the family could take care of you when you were disabled, or the friends or the neighbors could take care of you when you were disabled. But that period of disability would be relatively short. So for all of those reasons, the system limped along. Limped along. Along come the 1940s, 1950s, and the world really begins to change in a host of ways, in a host of ways. First of all, advances in medical technology begin to significantly increase or extend the gap between disability and death. It no longer was the case that if you became seriously ill, or if you became seriously disabled, the odds of your living months or years was practically nil. So you had people living not only longer in terms of average length of life, you know, but again, you had people living longer with disabilities. You also had significantly more women entering the workforce. I mean, that began, you know, it was a huge phenomenon during World War II. You know, all the guys went off to war, and a lot of the women took the jobs in the factories and other places, you know, back here in the States. It certainly continued being true post-World War II, and then escalated dramatically, of course, in the 1960s and 1970s, and certainly has continued to escalate through the 80s, 90s, and beyond. So that while it's surely the case that there are many women today, and some men, but many women today who don't have a full-time or even a part-time paid job and who, you know, fit sort of the more classic definition of a stay-at-home mom slash wife and therefore can easily take care of, well, not easily, but can take care of neighbors, relatives, and so forth, you've got more and more and more women today, and I don't know the percentages off the top of my head, but obviously, you know, a significantly increased percentage of women who are working either full-time or part-time and are still engaging in much of the informal caregiving that goes on today that still dominates long-term care, but are now doing it before work or after work or on weekends, you know, cooking up meals for the whole week to put in somebody's house so that, you know, so that a relative has meals to eat during the week, etc. So there's a much, you know, higher demand and burnout on informal caregivers. But at the same time, that was one of the factors that really began to pressure the system in significant ways to have, you know, to have other kinds of support systems other than these informal, unpaid females, women. So you had a longer gap between disability and death. You had more women entering the marketplace. And third factor, which again sort of is the flip side of the lack of mobility in the 1800s, you know, by the 1900s and certainly by the, you know, the late 20th and 21st century, we became a much more mobile society. You know, massive immigration, massive, you know, dislocation, you know, massive movement of populations from the north to the south, the east to the west, you know, the north, you know, on and on and on. So it certainly is no longer the case, you know, I mean, and again, I think I've mentioned just as one example, my own family with, you know, I have two sisters, one who lives in Seattle, Washington, and one who lives in Paris, France. And those are, I mean, they've been there for 20 years. I mean, that's their home. You know, and that, while maybe even a bit more extensive than the average family, is not atypical, completely atypical these days. And even if instead of New York, Seattle, Paris, you've got a family with New York, Washington, D.C., you know, Nashville, you know, it's, or even if it's New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, depending on where New York, New Jersey, Connecticut are, you know, it's not, you know, you don't just drop in. When you live in New Jersey and the relative lives in the Bronx, or when you live in, you know, the relative lives in the Bronx and the kids live in Westchester or Long Island, again, it's not the same kind of, you know, smaller community. And when I say small community, I'm not just talking rural. I mean urban, you know, there were years ago urban neighborhoods in which kids knew sort of the 8-10 blocks around which they were raised, and the fact that they lived in New York City or Baltimore or Boston, at least until they were teens, was almost irrelevant. I mean, their home was that community, and certainly in suburban and rural areas it was as well. So you had all these demographic changes. So you had the medical changes, you had the demographic changes. You also had the evolution of the private health insurance industry here in the United States, which, as we've talked about, really began in the 1940s, 1950s. And so people began thinking for the first time that, geez, maybe healthcare costs can and should be paid for either as a benefit of the workplace or at least clearly as a, you know, not out of my own pocket. You know, systems of insurance began to arise. System, you know, and we never really had in a significant way before the 1940s systems of public or private health insurance. You also had, you know, massive growth in the number of hospitals, as we've talked about weeks ago in this class. So all of these factors, demographic changes, medical changes, changes in the insurance system, changes in the provider system, changes in the delivery system, all of these changes begin to coalesce in the 1940s and 1950s. And there are pressures for the first time to think about what role the private sector should play, what role the insurance system should play, what role the public sector should play for a society in which this gap between disability and death was growing. Pressures begin to grow. Some of the first pressures begin to come and begin to grow from the hospital industry. Why do you think it is that hospitals were particularly concerned in the 1940s and 1950s about the lack of a real long-term care system? Any guesses?
They couldn't get people out.
People would come into the hospital, elderly folks would come. I mean, now there were these hospitals, there were these facilities, and people would show up at the hospital with some, you know, acute crisis. The hospital would stabilize the crisis, but there'd be no place to discharge the person. There'd be no place for them to go. And so the question was, well, what do we do? You know, do we sort of kick out some disabled person on the street? Do we keep them in a hospital bed? We're sure we make some money to the extent that the person has private health insurance, but many of the disabled don't have private health insurance. There's no Medicaid, there's no Medicare in the 40s and 50s. Many of these are uninsured folks. And even if they have insurance, and even if the hospital's making a few bucks off them, the hospital clearly says that's not our mission. You know, it's not our mission to have people sitting in beds, in effect receiving residential nursing care, when we want to become sort of the, you know, the top academic medical center in New York City or the world. So hospitals begin pushing and creating political pressure. Now, as the private insurance system evolved, as we developed Blue Cross, as we developed commercial insurance, did those insurance companies provide coverage for long-term care? No, why not? Why not? Cost, and not only is it expensive, but who was paying the bill for that private health insurance? Who was buying Blue Cross for their employees? I guess I kind of gave away the answer. Employers. We were developing this employer-sponsored health insurance system. And if you've agreed with a union or with whoever to provide health insurance for your employees, your goal is to get the employee who's sick into the doctor and back to the workforce as fast as possible. And you want to keep that employee happy. You want to keep that employee healthy. A happy and healthy workforce. You know, what better situation could you have? And so employers said, all right, we will pay for Blue Cross. We will pay for Aetna. We will pay for Oxford. But geez, once folks retire, once folks become disabled, once folks need help with the activities of daily living, once folks need long-term care services, once folks need to be institutionalized in a nursing home, what incentive do we as an employer have to pay that costly bill? And from the employer's perspective, the answer was none. So the private health insurance system that this country evolved, the employer-sponsored private health insurance system that evolved in the 30s, 40s, 50s, even 60s, 1960s in this country, that private health insurance system did not cover and generally does not cover long-term care services. It became the primary and the major gap in financing coverage of health care services here in the United States. And even today, in 2006, that's what year it is, 2006, even today, there are practically no employers that will pay for long-term care insurance for their employees. I mean, there is a bit of a trend today among some employers to say, all right, we will enter a contract with the private long-term care insurance company in which our employees can buy private long-term care insurance on their own through our, you know, but sort of use it, get it a group rate as opposed to an individual rate, but the employee has to pay 100% of that bill, him or herself. Most, if not all, employers say, we're not going to pay for private long-term care insurance. So if there was no private long-term care insurance, the next question that arose is, would there, could there, should there be a private long-term care insurance system that individuals themselves would purchase, that individuals themselves would buy, individually purchase private long-term care insurance? And indeed there is an industry, there is a system, there are insurance companies that sell private long-term care insurance. And yet, as you know, if you did the readings, as you know, not only do relatively few Americans have private long-term care insurance, but the amount of the long-term care bill that's paid by private long-term care insurance is very low. I think it's, 4 or 5% max. Most people do not have private long-term care insurance, and most people do not use private long-term care insurance to pay for the cost either of their nursing home care or the cost of their home care or their personal care or their assisted living or any of the classic long-term care services that we talk about. Why is that, do you think? Why is there so little private long-term care insurance here in the United States? Yeah? Okay. There were a few comments there, all of which were exactly on target. You know, one comment, for those of you who couldn't hear, was that the relatively few people who can afford private long-term care insurance, so let me stop there before moving on to the next comment. Private long-term care insurance is expensive. It's expensive. It's particularly expensive if you wait till you're 80 years old to buy it. It's still expensive, though, if you buy it at age 60. It's pretty cheap if you buy it at age 25. It's really cheap if you buy it at age 25. But very, 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 very few 25-year-olds even think about it much less seriously contemplate buying it, even though there is some inflation protection. Yeah?
I think there's also some concern that, say, through 25, your policy will not still be existing.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so one concern is that it's expensive. Let me just ask another concern. Well, let me sort of get to these in order. Why do you think it's so expensive? Why is private long-term care insurance expensive? Yeah. So people are going to need to use the service. When are they going to use the service, though? Well, and they're going to use the service a long time after they buy the policy. If they buy it, because remember, the younger you are when you buy it, the cheaper it is. The older you are, the more expensive it is. So, but if you're 50 years old and you're thinking of buying a long-term care insurance policy because you say it's actually affordable at age 50, you say to yourself, given your, I mean, if you're in a financial situation to do that, odds are you're not going to use that service, you know, for 20, 25, 30 years. You know, you'll use it when you're 70, 75, 80. But you're buying a policy now, and you're capping in at certain rates right now for a benefit that you're going to receive 25 years down the line, if at all, if at all. Maybe you won't receive it at all. Maybe you'll die, you know, of a heart attack in bed, you know, and you'll never use it. You know, what the hell? And that's not unrelated, because another reason, sort of just lumping lots of things together, is most people sort of have this vision to the extent, well, first of all, most young people, and I'm talking about you. No, most young, you know, most relatively young people are not interested in thinking about the fact that they're going to grow old someday, that they're going to become ill, that they may become disabled, that they may need nursing home services, that they may need home care services. That's the last thing on the mind of young people, first of all, to society, which values and treasures youth and doesn't want to think about aging. Second of all, young people have so many other, you know, they're trying to pay for graduate school, or they're trying to raise a family, or pay for tuition for their kids at college, or, you know, there's so many, pay a mortgage. I mean, there's so many other kind of expenses that seem more immediate than expenses 25 years down the line. And just culturally, as a society, we don't think a lot about aging, death, and disability. You know, relatively few, relatively young folks have a will. You know, I think, you know, the time in life when many, although not all by any stretch, but it's really when people get married that maybe they think they should have a will. Maybe if they have kids, they think they should have a will. But that's about it. And maybe when they get married, they buy a life insurance policy, or they get a life insurance policy. But that's about it. And most don't even do that. I mean, I'll bet you anything, although I'm not going to test it out because I don't want to put people on the spot, but I'll bet you anything that if we had one of those silent little voter things here where you pushed a button to say whether or not you have a will, remember how I asked you to look into your hearts around whether you came to the small group meetings the other day? I want you to look into your heart, and I want you to think about, do you have a will? You know, do you have life insurance? You know, I mean, most people when they're your age, and I know there's a gap in ages in this room, but given the gap, I mean, all the gaps, most people in this room just do not think about aging and disability and nursing home. And if they do think about death, if they do think about growing old, they say to themselves, geez, the one thing I do know is I'm never going into a nursing home. I mean, I saw what that nursing home was like that, you know, Grandma so-and-so was in. It was horrible. And never will I let that happen to me or anyone that I know and love. You know, I'm going to have this kind of, you know, I mean, maybe instead of having the heart attack and dying at night, you know, I'll be perfectly healthy till I'm 90. Then I'll contract pneumonia, but I'll be well enough that I have 2 weeks to kind of, you know, hang on to say goodbye to everybody, and then I, you know, disappear. You know, there was an article in the New York Times Magazine a few months ago, which I don't know how many of you saw, in which it talked about people's perception, to the extent people thought about it, but people's perception of what their own death would be like and how they wanted to plan for their, and this isn't, you're too young to even do this, but when you get to my age, people start thinking to themselves, well, you know, if I, you know, what would the perfect death be? I mean, we could have a real morbid conversation here, you know, but what would the perfect death be? And it's almost never like you plan. It just doesn't happen the way you think it's going to happen to almost anybody. But people don't engage in that kind of planning. So one thing, people don't want to think about that and talk about that. It's expensive. And now, why is it expensive? Number one, it's going to happen, if you're relatively young, it's going to happen 30 years down the line. So what does that mean if you're an insurance agent? If you were selling long-term care insurance in 1965 to a 45-year-old person, that was 40 years ago, right? 40 years ago. So you wanted to sell to a 40, 45-year-old person. You know, you figure that's the age you want to think about selling in private long-term care insurance policy. And you want to say to them, we're going to cover the cost of nursing home care and home care for you. Well, first of all, the cost of a nursing home in 1965 compared to the cost of a nursing home in 2006 is astronomically different. I mean, the average nursing home in the United States today, nationally, is somewhere between $66,000 and $70,000 a year. Here in New York City, it's probably over $100,000. It is over $100,000 a year for the typical nursing home, to be a resident in a nursing home for a year. In 1965, if you bought that policy, even using sort of an inflation-based adjustment, if you bought a benefit, so the actuaries for that insurance company, they're trying to predict what the cost would be for certain kind of services 20, 25 years down the line. That's very different from a typical health insurance policy. In a typical health insurance policy, every year the policy gets renewed. And every year they take into account changes in the cost of health care. They take into account, if you're buying on the individual market, remember this is individual policies, if you're buying on the individual market, every year they take into account your changed health care circumstances to the extent that they can legally. But now the actuaries are trying to predict what these costs are going to be 20, 25 years down the line. So number one, they're a little cautious. Actuaries by nature, I don't know if there's any in here, but they're a cautious breed. And number two, what they're going to do is they're going to try to protect the insurance company by imposing some real limits on that benefit. So maybe they'll say in 2005, we will sell you, 50-year-old person, a benefit today, a long-term care policy today, that will pay for the cost of a nursing home today plus, 3% a year inflation. So that by the time you go into a nursing home, if you go into a nursing home in 2020 or 2030, what that insurance company is going to agree to have paid is the 2005 rate plus some inflation. There's liable to be a huge gap between what the benefit pays and what the actual real cost is in 2025. And so the cost of the insurance is expensive. The benefit is often limited. The benefit often doesn't pay the whole bill by the time you need it. So you end up having to pay a lot out of pocket anyway. So it's an expensive benefit. It gives you a relatively limited benefit. It may well be, and there have been studies that suggest, someone over here, I can't remember who pointed out, that a lot of the companies that were selling private long-term care insurance in 1980 are no longer in existence today in 2006. And if you bought private long-term care insurance from them 25 years ago, you could just be out of luck. So there's no even guarantees that that company is still going to be around when you need it, unless you're real care, particularly if you buy a cheap policy. If you buy a more expensive policy from a more established company, maybe they'll be around, although you never know. But if you buy a cheap policy, it could be from a fly-by-night that's gone. And you don't want to think about the whole subject anyway. So for all of those reasons, private long-term care insurance has been a very, very, very tough, slow sell. We're going to talk later in the hour, about efforts in the 2000s to try to build up the private long-term care insurance market. And there's lots of efforts to do that today. So we'll talk about that later. But and there has been some growth. About 15 to 18% a year growth in the industry over the last 5-6 years. Starting from a pretty low base, but there is some growth. We'll talk about that later. But historically, not a lot of private long-term care insurance in the United States. So we have not had much from the private sector. No employer-sponsored long-term care coverage, very little in the individual private long-term care insurance market. So the question then became, what, if anything, was the public's role, the government's role? Should government be providing some assistance to people who need long-term care services? In 1950, Congress amended the Social Security Act to say that people who resided in institutions like nursing homes could actually receive old age assistance if they were low income. Before 1950, I mean, the Social Security Act was enacted in the 1930s, part of the Social Security Act included systems of old age assistance for elderly, particularly elderly low-income folks, but if you went into an institution, you were not eligible to receive that money. 1950, Congress says, all right, if you go into an institution, you can receive old age assistance, and maybe if you turn that over to the nursing home or the facility, you know, they can use that to pay for the cost of your care. So that was one way government tried to think about providing some aid and assistance to folks who needed long-term care services. In 1954, Congress amended the Hill-Burton Act. Hill-Burton, as you may remember from conversations earlier this semester, Hill-Burton was an act that had been passed in 1946. And what Hill-Burton did was give money to hospitals or give money to business people to build hospitals to try to build up the hospital industry here in the United States. Well, in 1954, Congress said to the hospitals, because remember, the hospitals were really, you know, nervous and ticked off and pressuring Congress because they had all these disabled folks sitting in their facilities that they didn't know what to do with. So Congress says, you know what, you can use Hill-Burton money, you can use Hill-Burton money to build a nursing home that is affiliated with and on the campus of the hospital. So Congress says, let's use some federal money to try to leverage some growth in the nursing home industry here in the United States. In 1960, Congress enacts the Kerr-Mills program, which we talked about when we were talking about the evolution of the Medicaid program. And what Kerr-Mills did in 1960 was say that the states could get federal dollars to provide health assistance and health care to indigent elderly and then soon thereafter indigent disabled. So for the first time, the states had a pot of federal money to use on health care and long-term care services if they wanted to for the elderly indigent and the elderly and the disabled indigent in their states. So those were all relatively small efforts by the federal government in the 1950s and early 1960s to try to cope with this emerging crisis that had been created by the demographic changes, by the political changes, by the insurance changes, by the delivery changes, by the health care changes, by all the changes that we talked about in the 1940s and 1950s. And then, of course, in 1965, what was enacted in 1965? Medicare and Medicaid. And if you couldn't answer that question, you flunked the course, because, just kidding. Well, actually, maybe not kidding, but that's besides the point. 1965, Congress enacts Medicare and Medicaid. Now, one might think that Medicare would cover long-term care services because, of course, the goal of Medicare was to provide health insurance to the elderly and to the disabled. And clearly, one of the health care needs of elderly and disabled folks are long-term care services. I mean, that's the group that needs them the most. Actually, that's the only groups that need them. You have to be disabled in some way to need long-term care services. But, as you all know, lo and behold, Medicare does not and did not cover any long-term care defined as long-term care. That was a great statement. It doesn't cover any long-term care defined. Never mind. Have I been mumbling to myself more than I used to, like in the front of this place? I find myself doing that on occasion, and I'm thinking to myself, and this is all being recorded too. It's like, who's that crazy man in front of the class, sort of, you know, mumbling? Medicare followed the private insurance model. The private insurance model said, we're going to cover hospital insurance. Remember, that was the Lyndon Johnson proposal. We're going to cover hospital insurance, and we're going to cover physician's insurance. Medicare, when it was enacted, basically created Part A and Part B. Part A covered hospital insurance, Part B covered physician's insurance. There was no coverage for long-term care. There was no coverage for long-term care. Even today in 2006, Medicare does not officially cover any long-term care. Now, Medicare does cover what it considers to be short-term, not long-term, short-term follow-up care to acute care episodes. So, if you go into a hospital, and then the hospital says, you know, we think we need to discharge you to a nursing home, Medicare will pay some, though not all, but certainly a big chunk of the cost of that nursing home coverage for the first 100 days you're in the hospital. The idea being, we're not going to cover you, Medicare is not going to pay the bill if you live in the nursing home for 5 years. That's long-term care. You know, that's you're there forever. But if you need to go into a nursing home for a relatively short stay, you know, you need some rehab services, you need some follow-up services, or if your doctor says, you know, you can go home now, Mrs. Smith, but we need to send a nurse from the Visiting Nurse Association to your apartment, you know, to change a bandage, you know, twice a week for the next month, or to, you know, provide some other short-term follow-up care, Medicare will pay for that. So Medicare will pay for 100 days of nursing home care following the hospitalization, and it will pay for home health care services, short-term home health care services prescribed by a physician. Now, through the 1960s, 1970s, 1980s, and early 1990s, Medicare paid just a very small percentage of the nursing home and home care bill here in the United States. Most people who went into nursing homes stayed there a lot more than 100 days. And the cost of home care was pretty low. So the Medicare percentage of the nation's long-term care bill in 1990, I have it in my notes somewhere, but in 1990, was probably 4 or 5% at most. Don't quote me on that exact figure, but the idea was it was low. And Feldman, you know, it's in the readings anyway if you want the exact figure, but it was low. In the early 1990s, the percentage of the long-term care bill that Medicare paid and pays began to escalate dramatically. And there were really two reasons for that. So much so that today, in 2000, and, well, I think the figures from 2004, but by 2003, 2004, Medicare pays 25% of the nation's long-term care bill. And one interesting thing that I should point out, that again is in the readings, but that I should point out, when I say 25% of the nation's long-term care bill, I'm talking about 25% of the $150, $160 billion a year that is actually spent on long-term care services. As Penny Feldman points out in her chapter, there's another $250 to $260 billion. There's an economic value of $250, $260 billion additional dollars in services that even today are still provided at no charge through the informal long-term care systems that we have by friends, family members, and the like. But of the amount of money that's paid, Medicare pays 25% of the bill today. And that happened really for two main reasons. Reason number one was that the nation's nursing home industry in the 1990s began to change a little bit. And it began to focus more and more on short-term rehab stays and less on sort of long-term chronic stays. So more and more people began floating through nursing homes for shorter periods of time. One of the reasons for that was to generate Medicare revenue. But that became a trend in the 90s. The second reason was that home care services funded by Medicare escalated hugely, dramatically, in the early 90s. And there were lots of reasons for that, and Penny Feldman talks about at least three of them in her chapter, so you can take a look at that. I mean, in sort of a settlement of court litigation, which meant that more people were eligible for Medicare-covered home care services, changes in utilization rules that meant they were getting more hours covered, you know, the way their services were paid for. There was all sorts of things that went on in the early 1990s that led to a dramatic escalation in the Medicare home care bill. And the Balanced Budget Act in 1997, which we've talked about previously, began an effort by the federal government to slash home care payments and to cut Medicare home care payments. But all those details of the story aside, today Medicare pays about 25% of the long-term care bill. That 25% is still primarily home care, much less nursing home care. But Medicare has become more of a payer. But it's still not, you know, again, if we're saying employer-sponsored insurance pays zero, private, you know, individual insurance pays 4%, and Medicare pays 25% of home care and nursing home care, but less of nursing home, then the question is, who pays the rest of the bill? And there were and are two main pots for the rest of the bill. And what are those two main pots? Medicaid and your own money, self-pay, out-of-pocket. So let me first talk a little bit about Medicaid for a few minutes in long-term care. When Medicaid was enacted in 1965, it became the first payer, the first third-party payer in American history to cover long-term care services. One consequence of Medicaid covering long-term care was that there was a dramatic expansion in the nation's nursing home industry. The nursing home industry pre-Medicaid, and again, there had been some efforts to build it up through the Hill-Burton amendments I was talking about and some of the other things I was talking about, you know, that took place in the 50s and 60s, but pre-Medicaid, there were between 250,000 and 300,000 nursing home beds in the United States. That's how many there were in 1963. Probably around 270,000, 280,000 nursing home beds in the United States. By 1973, 8 years after the enactment of Medicaid, there were 1.3 million nursing home beds in the United States. So there were almost, there were more than a million nursing home beds that were established, that were created between 1963 and 1973. Today, in 2004, there's 1.7 million nursing home beds. So we went from, you know, say 270,000 in 1963 to 1.3 million in 1973 to 1.7 million in 2004. So you had growth of about a million beds in the 10-year period before, just after Medicaid was enacted, really in the 8-year period from 65 to 73, even though the figure I have is from 63. That 8-year period, you really had a million new beds. In the 30 years since, you've had 400,000 new beds. So Medicaid prompted, and why did it prompt it? Because now there was somebody to pay the bill. Now there was somebody, there was an insurance, the government was going to pay the bill. And not only would government pay the bill for the beneficiary residing in the nursing home, but Medicaid would even pay for some of the capital costs that you incurred building the nursing home. So a huge fiscal incentive generated by government to build a new industry, to build a nursing home industry. Medicaid did not have nearly the same effect on home care. Medicaid had much tighter rules and was much more restrictive about paying for home care. And why do you think that was? And still is today to a large degree. Yeah? It's harder to regulate in a lot of ways, in a host of ways. You're absolutely right. What Medicaid officials worried about is what the economists call the Woodwork effect. And what's the Woodwork effect? It's people coming out of the woodwork to claim services. Remember, we have $260 billion in informal care that's being rendered primarily by community members, neighbors, friends, family members that they're not being paid a dime for. If all of a sudden government said, we will pay for almost any kind of informal home care, we will pay for almost any kind of home care, the fear was all sorts of services that were now being provided informally would instead be provided formally through the Medicaid program. You know, the neighbor down the street would say, instead of me, you know, coming over every other night and taking care of you and providing the basic home care services, you know, why don't you go on to Medicaid and get a home care worker through Medicaid and have the government pay the bill. So Medicaid has always been worried about home care costs. And so there has been built into the Medicaid program historically, and one of the big issues today is an effort to reverse this, but there historically has been a big institutional bias in the Medicaid program. Medicaid was much more willing to pay for nursing home care for the truly disabled than to pay for home care in situations in which not only they weren't sure who was getting the care, not only weren't they sure what kind of quality the care would be because it was taking place on a one-on-one basis in a home, not only weren't they sure who was providing the care, but they weren't sure how they were going to pay the bill. But institutional bias in favor of nursing homes in the Medicaid program. That led to a delivery system in which we had lots of nursing homes, you know, a million new nursing home beds, relatively few new home care agencies, relatively little home care services. Medicaid said we will pay for nursing homes, we will pay, but we're going to tightly control home health care. Medicaid also said we will pay for what we call personal care services, which are things that are not even really traditional medical services. It's things like helping you, you know, get up in the morning, get dressed, and go shopping. Medicaid will pay for some of those services, those personal care services, on the theory that by providing those services, you could actually be saving money because the person who gets those services doesn't become more seriously ill, more seriously disabled. But whether or not you cover personal care services is up to the state, and not every state covers personal care services. Who wants to guess which state has by far the biggest personal care system in the United States? It's not Arizona. It was a trick question. See? I got you. No, it's New York State. New York State, New York City, but New York State more generally, spends more on personal care services in its Medicaid program than the other 49 states combined. Yeah? Right. Home care, a service is prescribed by a doctor, by a physician, where the physician basically says the bandage needs to be changed or the insulin needs to be provided or, you know, there's a medical procedure. Personal care services are, by definition, not medical, although they have medical consequences, you know, if not provided. So it's up to the state. So Medicare generally doesn't cover personal care services. But Medicaid says if the state wants to cover them, you know, they can. Yeah? I understand New York has a tax on personal care. Well, that's not exactly true. But New York always had by far the most generous personal care program in the country for lots of reasons. And so it meant that New York was spending so much more than everybody else. And sort of the whole question around the personal care system in New York began to revolve around there was a cadre of folks who receive 24-hour, 7-day-a-week, one-on-one personal care service. In other words, they have, you know, through a shift of 8-hour shifts or whatever it is, 3 personal care attendants in the home of the Medicaid recipients. And that is very, very, very expensive to provide one-on-one care. I mean, for people who are wealthy, who can afford it, it's expensive, but they pay it and they can afford it. For Medicaid to pay that bill is really expensive. It's also not necessarily the best thing for the patient, for the client. you know, I mean, just having someone there for 24 hours a day sit there and watch TV while you sit there and watch TV, you know, it could well be better getting that person, you know, both of you out of the house into a, you know, an adult day center or, you know, mingling with other people, you know. So it's not always the best thing clinically either. There were in the, you know, there's always been a political battle, though, over that personal care program. And so I forget when, sometime in the 1990s, the state legislature imposed a rule that said if you're going to spend more on the personal care services that you provide to Mrs. Smith than it would cost to have Mrs. Smith in a nursing home, then you have to justify it. So in theory, there's a rule that requires you to justify, you know, 24/7 personal care, and to try and the idea is to not use it when it's not appropriate or medically indicated or whatever. But typically, so whether you call that a cap or not depends on your definition of a cap. On the one hand, it's not that hard to get around that rule if you write your request well. On the other hand, that rule does deter some 20. You know, it has led to a decline in 24/7 care. But most other states in the country, I think Texas has the second highest personal care rate, and then maybe California. But most other states that have, I think 32 states have a personal care program and 18 don't. But most of the states that have personal care have real caps. What just happened here? Why did this stop? Wait. Didn't this happen once before? The battery died or something? Is this on? Did it come back on?
No.
All right, let me see. Is this on? Could you hear this? All right, well, I guess I don't know why. Do I just use these batteries up? And I think that's the only thing I could think as to why this wouldn't be working now, why it just would stop like that. All right, let me put this one back in. All right, so what were we talking about? Oh, personal care. Most other states, right. Most other states have rules that say you can get a maximum of 2 or 4 hours a day of personal care services. You know, so someone can come for a couple hours a day, but most states don't have anything like 24-hour daycare. And that's become very political because, obviously, it's very expensive. I mean, I think New York spends probably $2 billion a year on its personal care program. But any efforts to change or cut that become fiercely resisted by, you know, advocates for seniors and disabled populations. There's a question way over there. Okay, that's a very good question. Long-term care services in general have to be authorized based on a needs assessment that's done. You have to be determined to be sufficiently disabled to qualify for those services. And that assessment, states vary in who does that assessment. Typically what the states will do is have a nurse, sometimes a social worker or a team, make an assessment of a client, and then the state has their own sort of needs assessment scorecard. And you're entitled to, you know, Medicaid, even if you go into a nursing home, Medicaid will only pay the nursing home bill if you're deemed seriously disabled enough so that you need nursing home care. And they'll similarly only pay for home care services if you're deemed disabled enough to qualify. Yeah? Well, there's two parts to that question. One, there's the general Medicaid eligibility levels, you know, which vary by state, which we've talked about in this class, which are pretty low. For nursing home coverage, there's a higher, states are required to provide nursing home coverage to people with 3 times the SSI eligibility rates, which is about $560 a month. So, you know, it's still relatively low for states. Where it becomes a big issue, and which we're going to talk, potentially a big issue, is there are lots of allegations and lots of anecdotal suggestions and evidence that there's all sorts of middle class and upper middle class folks that are transferring their assets inappropriately to become Medicaid eligible. So we'll talk about that. That's sort of the politically explosive question around this. you know, the actual eligibility levels are pretty low. Although if you go into a nursing home and the nursing home costs $100,000 a year, you know, you're pretty quickly going to spend any money you have and your income won't cover it, so you become impoverished by that. But there is a question about people who have maybe $200,000 a year who try to transfer it so they can go on to Medicaid more quickly. Just about everybody who goes into a nursing home ends up, if they live long enough, going on to Medicaid. Because if you're Bill Gates, you never go into a nursing home. I mean, if you really have a lot of money, you don't go into a nursing home. You have a 24/7, you know, someone in your house. So, you know, you just live at home and stay at home because you can really afford that. So it's really sort of middle class, working class, and poor people that go into nursing homes. And even the middle class folks end up spending their money pretty quickly. And then they become Medicaid eligible. Okay. So that's Medicaid. And we're going to talk a lot more about Medicaid in terms of some of those transfer of asset things in a few minutes. And then the final payer for long-term care services is self-pay. And that's everybody from, you know, wealthy folks paying for home attendance, and not even necessarily wealthy, you know, upper middle class folks that have, you know, baby boomer kids that will help pay for a home attendant, you know, for mom or dad who needs it, you know, when they become seriously disabled. You know, there's also, or people who go into the nursing home, you know, with $100,000 in the bank and spend that $100,000 for the nursing home, out of pocket pays about 33% of the long-term care bill. So basically, when it comes to long-term care generally, Medicaid pays 35% of the bill, out of pocket pays 33% of the bill, Medicare pays 25% of the bill, private long-term care insurance pays 4% of the bill, and other, which is everything from the veterans to, I mean, all sorts of other things, pay 3% of the bill. That's long-term care general. Nursing home costs, Medicaid pays about 49% of the bill. So while nursing home, while Medicaid only pays 35% of the total long-term care bill, it pays almost 50% of the nursing home bill. And just like in nursing home, Medicare pays 25% of the long-term care bill, but a much smaller percentage of the nursing home bill. So that's sort of who pays the bill and the evolution of who pays the bill. Why don't we take a short break and then come back and talk about the delivery system and changes under the delivery system and the rising cost of long-term care and things like that.